Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's our week in review. On Monday, we were worried about hospital capacity.
Every conversation with healthcare leaders begins and ends right now with staffing.
By Thursday night, it seemed like 2020 all over again.
It's literally going to be difficult for us to meet the demands of our communities.
Steve Walsh of the Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association there. And as the pandemic ramps up, and we thought we were already ramped up, the legislature lets pandemic-era voting laws expire.
To extend the existing situation as we have it, nothing more, but nothing less.
This is something that voters are expecting moving forward because it has been used for so many elections.
And they watch the timer run out on the state's supply of eggs.
The wheels of government grind exceedingly slowly.
I hate to raise prices, but how do you avoid it?
You just heard Secretary of the Commonwealth Bill Galvin, Concord Town Clerk Carrie Miteri, Bill Powell of the New England Brown Egg Council, and John Pergantis, owner of Party Favors. Now, meanwhile, the Danvers school community is racked by yet more incidents of hate. Some weeks you just have to ask, WTH, what the heck? Greater Boston. And we will start with COVID's newest offering, Omicron. Do you feel like you're being dragged back to 2020, worried about losing your holidays? What are you anticipating for January? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. Our panelists today, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor, writer for the Boston Globe, and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti, and Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and now CEO of Verdant Medical, a cannabis company. Tom, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here.
Tito, welcome back to you too.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so I feel like we have to give everyone, including ourselves, a moment of compassion today as the news unfolds about Omicron. It seems like the news is unfolding even faster than the variant itself is spreading. Tito, how are you thinking about it today?
Well, I'm just thinking back to when this was supposed to be 3 weeks of huddling down and now where we are today. I think it is going to just really require vigilance. It's going to really require individuals to step forward and actually go ahead and actually get your shots. We know that the deaths that are actually occurring now are almost exclusively individuals who have not received shots, from what we're hearing from medical professionals. And then we also are going to be leaning even more so on the research pharma biotech community to come out with something that is going to address the Omicron, and also go and get your booster shot. I actually just got mine this week, and we're just going to have to really hunker down and be vigilant, in particular over this holiday season when we're going to all be around each other, and in particular for schools when individuals go back in January.
So, Tom, I'm going to play a little sound here from Dr. Juan Pablo Casas Romero, epidemiologist at Brigham and Women's, who told our newscast team about the dangers with the unvaccinated and Omicron.
27% remain to be vaccinated, which is probably around 1.8 million people having had at least one dose. So this is an incredibly large reservoir for the virus to circulate and create many more cases and hospitalization.
I basically had to have a live ticker on the side of my screen as I was prepping for today this morning, Tom, because things were happening so quickly. Bruins game postponed due to COVID cases. Northeastern detects multiple Omicron cases, bans spectators from athletic events. Is it, as Tito says, and as Dr. Juan Pablo Casas Romero was saying there, is this because of the unvaccinated, or are we also just getting beat by this thing?
Well, I think it's quite clear that Omicron is differently transmissible, right? I mean, one study shows that it's 70 times more transmissible than the Delta variant. So it isn't just about the unvaccinated. This is spreading like wildfire, and it spreads like wildfire even among people who have been vaccinated. I think the difference we have now, however, is that we're seeing that the damage that it's doing is to the people who have been unvaccinated. That's without question the case. It's a huge number of people. It's just in the millions, even in this state. And that's, I think, where we're really going to see the damage. But those folks can't hide from it anymore. that, you know, that this is so transmissible that even if they're in the company of vaccinated people, they could potentially get the virus. So it's a terribly disturbing situation, and one very frustratingly that could be solved, really, if they would simply go get vaccinated.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join this conversation. What do you see as the policy solution most important in front of us right now? More vaccinations, faster boosters, statewide mask mandate? Let us know what you think. Tito, I'm going to play a little sound here from the president and CEO of Bay State Health. This is Mark Kerouac, who told Nirvani Williams of New England News Collaborative about his support for a statewide indoor mask mandate.
My own feeling is that even if you can increase mask wearing a little bit by having a mandate, it's probably a good idea. So I would love to see the governor change his mind and do a mask mandate, and as many of the leaders of the towns and municipalities take the plunge as well.
And the governor's been pretty clear, Tito, that is not on the table right now. Now, I want to be really clear. Over the last couple of years, and it is almost a couple full 2 years now, we've seen a lot of tension back and forth between when decisions on policy should be left to municipalities and when they should be statewide. And I recognize we can move back and forth between those things, Tito. But when do we move back and forth? And is it a time now to move to a statewide mandate rather than leaving it to local cities and towns?
And I think at this point, we should be using data as we have used in the past to make these decisions. I think at this day, I'm not sure if moving there today, but I think it's something that we should be really thinking of in bringing people back into school buildings and folks post holiday season going back to being at work and at school. So I think it's something that should be really considered in the very near future because we definitely want to get ahead rather than behind. And I think the worst thing that could happen is things get so overrun that we, instead of having a mask mandate, would have another shelter in place mandate, which has a whole host of issues to the economy, as well as the mental health and wellness of young people, as well as those who are not so young.
So, Tom, there's always a suite of solutions available to us, right? Or we hope that there's a suite of policy options. I'm going to play some sound from Monday. Governor Charlie Baker, Monday morning, announcing the distribution of more than 2 million rapid at-home tests to 102 cities and towns in the Commonwealth.
5 million people are fully vaccinated. 1.5 million of those are boosted. Over 6 million people have at least one dose. And we continue to focus aggressively on those communities and those populations that are most vulnerable. There's a ton of activity going on in that space to keep those people safe. They're tested all the time with respect to COVID, and that's going to continue to happen until it doesn't need to anymore.
So there is this suite, Tom. Mask mandate I asked Tito about a second ago. You've got distribution of tests. You've got boosters. You've got core vaccines. You've got social distancing. You know, you've got later the potential, God forbid, of a shutdown again. How do we responsibly now, today, knowing what we know now versus, let's say, even a year ago now, but with this juggernaut that Omicron appears to be, how do we think about the balance between those things?
So I think you have to think about it a little bit politically, and you have to realize that mandates and lockdowns come with their own backlash. And you have to think about, where am I going to spend my political capital in terms of trying to get a result? I think Baker is actually correct in not moving towards a mask mandate. Masks are perhaps effective, but only at the margins. And given the transmissibility of Omicron, they probably won't matter that much. What is effective is getting vaccinated. And if you're going to do a mandate, I would suggest going in that direction rather than start trying to get people to wear masks.
1-800-423-8255. Lots of calls coming in. Let's hear from Janelle in Roxbury. Janelle, go ahead.
Hi. So I'm just wondering, we know that Omicron is more contagious, but it seems like the symptoms are more mild and people are getting less sick and there's less deaths, if I'm correct. So my question is that a good sign? Is that a sign that the virus is changing in a way that's more like the common cold or the flu?
So, Janelle, I appreciate that. And as Tito, as I turn to you, what I'm going to tell you is that based on the conversations we have had with experts this week, we are still We are clearly seeing higher rates of transmissibility. It does not yet appear in the data that Omicron is a particularly severe illness compared to the variant, let's say, Delta. But I want to be really clear that the doctors are consistently telling us we are still watching that data. But with that in mind, is there a point, Tito, where I do not mean to be glib. This becomes more like a cold, which, by the way, is a coronavirus, and we scale back because it spreads, but people don't get as sick?
I definitely don't think we're at that point. And I do go back to, I had Omicron's little brother, because I had this disease in March of last year. It really wiped me out for the time that I had it. And then I had about 6 months of a 6 month time frame of a great deal of fatigue. So I think the other piece that people need to think about is not only the acute phase of the coronavirus, and the real piece that I think also people need to think about all are those long haul individuals who have all kinds of other disease states that are related to catching it. And I don't think we have the data and the time needed to assess that. So I think we still have to aggressively fight the spread of Omicron and take all of the measures needed in order to continue to put up a real fight.
I want to welcome Nikki's call from Cape Cod. Nikki, go ahead.
Hi, I was just calling because my boyfriend and I both live with a 20-year-old who refuses to get the vaccine, and we've never had a reason given as to why. My mom's 80 next November, and for 3 years we've been planning to go back to England to celebrate her and see my family, and I'm afraid that's not going to happen unless we can get more people vaccinated. And we're all intelligent in this household. We all understand different points of view. I just don't understand what we can do to change the situation in families where people literally are choosing a hill to die on. It's very scary, and I'm hoping that there's a way around this, that, you know, I can go see my family again.
Nikki, I do hope you get to go see your family again. My heart goes out to you about your mom. It really does. And I'm going to juxtapose that, Tom Keene, with some sound from Ask the Doctors this week. This is Dr. Philip Landergan, who's a pediatrician, public health physician, epidemiologist, and the director of the Program for Global Public Health at Boston College. And he's talking to parents of kids ages 12 to 15.
I would think, you know, even if it's a bit off-label, if you have a chance to get a booster for a 12 to 15-year-old who had their shots more than, say, 4 months ago, if you could get it, I would take it. It can harm, and it could increase the degree of protection.
So here we've got Nikki on the one hand saying that a 20-year-old who's eligible for first vaccination has not gotten one. And you have a pediatrician saying they're not authorized even for emergency use yet, but if your pediatrician will do it, get your 12-year-old vaccinated. How do we, I mean, I feel like I've been asking this for 20 solid months or less because we haven't had vaccines that long, but how do we get people to the same place? Those differences are striking, Tom Keene.
They're extremely striking. You know, I'd probably lean in the position of going for an off-label use and actually getting a booster. And in effect, I kind of got my booster, you know, before it really was on label too. The vaccines clearly do work. I have no idea and cannot understand the resistance from folks. I would say to Nikki that, you know, the only way around it, that in terms of a short-term visit or something, might be to ensure that everyone gets tested. But that's certainly a lot riskier still than simply having a 20-year-old getting vaccinated.
So I do want to, I'm not going to go to this call, but we had a call, Nicola from Lexington, wanting us to clarify, and I will. Often you'll see it reported that Omicron is 70 times more infectious. Technically, it's 70 times, it replicates in the airways 70 times faster than Delta. So she asked for that clarification, and in fact, that is technically the clarification there. So just wanted to give everybody a heads up on that. The phones continue to just be pouring in here. Let's take Jess from Middlesex County. Jess, go ahead. Jess, go ahead. Can you hear me?
No.
Okay, but I hear a munchkin in the background. So let's stay with this idea, Tito, of getting kids vaccinated. And I want to, okay, this vaccine thing. We're going to play some sound that Amanda put together. This is two different pieces of sound. Dr. Anthony Fauci encouraging people and educating people about J&J in a White House official video from April. And then we hear a news anchor at CNBC announcing this week's news from the CDC on J&J.
I would definitely take the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. This is a vaccine that works, and it only requires one dose.
An advisory panel to the CDC has just voted unanimously to have a preferential recommendation for the mRNA vaccines, either Pfizer or Moderna, over the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So here they are not limiting its use, but they are putting out a preference.
So truth in advertising, my first dose, I am boosted now, but Johnson & Johnson. Tito, we started with kind of a framing of this week of what the heck, and you could understand people saying, what the heck? After a pivot like that, that hurts in public health messaging to get people who are vaccine resistant on board.
So I also do need to disclose I worked for Johnson & Johnson in my first job out of college.
I did not know that.
Yes, I did. I was in pharmaceutical sales for Johnson & Johnson as well as Eli Lilly. But I will note, there is in the drug space and the pharma space, there's a million patient mark. And so what you typically see in drug development, if there are significant issues around side effects and the like, as well as efficacy issues, that million patient mark is one in which you'll begin to see that. We're moving so fast, and we have to move so fast that this is iterative. And I think it is really important that, in particular, someone who had the J&J in the front end, that we get ahead of it in relative to the booster side in terms of what folks should be taking. And now there's also this piece around if you had, I had two Pfizer, so someone told me I should take a Moderna, and that's actually the one that I got. And so as to what is actually going to work. But I think it is important that in real time that a pause button is hit. And I think Mr. Fauci did the right thing. But it is disconcerting, and we are going to have to roll with the punches relative to this.
So one more topic I want to bring up on this before we go to break, Tom Keene. Here is Steve Walsh, head of the Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association, talking about hospital capacity concerns. He was talking with WBUR's Gabriella Emanuel.
Hospital capacity is stretched more than it has ever been since the beginning of the healthcare emergency. Right? We have avoided the dire scenarios that are being seen in other states, but capacity is a challenge every single day.
I think about that as we talk about hoping that Omicron maybe causes less severe illness. But when we are already tapped out due to staffing shortages, people who deferred care before, how worried are you about what January looks like in the Commonwealth? Or do you think we've got sort of the resilience to absorb this?
I think the Commonwealth is probably in better shape than a lot of other states. But having said that, if this continues to grow and if you continue to see people going into hospitals, what's going to happen is other people with other situations will see their care being postponed or whatever. And that has a real cost. I mean, we certainly saw the first time around on this that people were avoiding, say, like screenings for cancer. And you then start seeing those cases for cancer emerge. That really is unfortunately, the situation it looks like we're going to be facing early this winter.
Still with us, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor, Globe writer and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti, and Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and now CEO of Verdant Medical. And you, inaction by the legislature ends no-excuse mail-in voting during the pandemic. It also, wait for it, puts your egg supply, yep, the supply of eggs that you buy at the grocery store, at risk. Are you frustrated? Are you surprised? Do you feel like you can get your legislature to act on the things that are important to you? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet at Radio Boston. So, Tito, Tom, the legislature chose to let pandemic-era voting measures expire. So I want to be clear. Specifically, no excuse mail-in voting and extended early voting hours in locations, which were put in place during the pandemic. Apparently, the Senate and House both want it, but the devil was in the details over competing legislation. We didn't have these rights before the pandemic, but also the pandemic isn't over. So I will ask again, Tito, what the heck?
I want to quote a famous individual right now, the lyricist, poet, and rapper Redman. Time for some action. It is really critical that the legislature deal with the real right that we have, which is the right to be enfranchised with the right to vote and to not be impeded for our vote. And so in this situation where you can vote in advance, which is a really smart thing, and in particular at a time when we have a coronavirus outbreak, it's not the normal election day when everybody goes at one time. We should be dealing with that. Mail-in voting, and I've also been a proponent of same-day voter registration, but this is a situation where we should not be rolling back the clock with people's access to be able to vote. These are pieces, actually, regardless of Corona or not, that actually should have stayed in place permanently. And I would encourage my friends in the legislature to get a move on relative to this for the upcoming elections.
Tom Keene, let me just explain for listeners who may not know. No excuse mail-in voting, which is the pandemic era measure, means you can get a mail-in ballot for any reason. There aren't, and you know, you don't have to have a special reason or a particular kind of excuse for that. We had Secretary of State Galvin on earlier this week talking about this. Here he is.
This is ridiculous. Everyone says they're for it. It's worked well. And I think what's particularly galling to me is, you know, we see what's going on nationally and around the country, the obvious and relentless effort to restrict the rights of voters for partisan reasons. We should be leading in the opposite direction.
So, you know, what strikes me is context, Tom, right? Tito already talked about the fact that these were pandemic-era measures. We're still in a pandemic. We just spent the first third of the show talking about the latest surge that we're facing. But also, we are having a national fight over voting rights right now. Massachusetts is a blue state with a blue legislature. You would think we'd have gone in the other direction here.
Spent the last year criticizing Georgia and Texas for, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you remember last summer, Major League Baseball canceled the All-Star game in Atlanta because of its reversal of voting reforms. I don't know what they're going to do to Massachusetts if we don't fix this. But it is absolutely absurd that we are now behind the ball, behind the curve, rather than ahead of it.
So 1-800-423-8255. We've got Janet on the line in Cambridge. Janet, go ahead.
Thanks a lot for taking my call. I wanted to reset the table. We should not be talking about an emergency measure that expired on December 31st, 2020, which is just extending mail-in voting. I mean, we've had mail in the United States for 200-plus years. This is not what we should be talking about. The Votes Act was filed by Senator Cindy Cream and Representative John Lawn in January of this year. It includes making mail-in permanent. It has same-day registration. It has jail-based voting reforms. It has gone through the Senate. We've had lobby days. That is the bill we should be talking about. We're behind in so many ways. The Votes Act is on the table. Please let's stop talking about, are we going to extend this emergency measure another 3 months or 6 months or whatever. Let's talk about the Votes Act.
Thanks,
and
Janet.
Registration.
And to be clear, so Tito, I'm going to give you a chance to answer Janet, but I want to set this up a little bit for listeners. So one, the things that we're talking about expiring, we're talking about expiring December 31st, 2021, this year. Two, there are two parts to this conversation. One, can we and should we extend the temporary measures that have already been put in place? And then two, should we be taking steps for more permanent measures to make voting easier? The last piece is Janet's talking about the Votes Act filed by the state Senate in October. There was a House move in July around the budget bill, and those two things have not been reconciled. So just so that everybody understands kind of where we are at play in policy and what Janet's talking about. So, Tito, with all of that in mind, I'll give you a chance to react to Janet's call.
Hear, hear, Janet. I believe Janet has it spot on. We should be leading and not following in all of these measures. We should have locked in all of the things that happen under the quote-unquote emergency. And as you noted properly, Tiziana, we are still in that state of emergency, and debatably we could be in even a worse state of emergency in the next elections. But also these underlying issues about the about people being able to vote and exercise their right to vote while they're in prison, as well as people not having to lie about mail-in voting. So I just want to be just drill down on that component. And Tom and I both ran elections in the city of Boston. You had to really be absent to do an absentee ballot in the city of Boston. It couldn't be you had to work or deal with those issues. So people are essentially breaking the law and having to lie to government when they don't have this law in place. That is a silly, silly thing. And I think we have all of these areas where things are really easy. You can open a bank account today and take money out of it. Why can't you do the same thing for voting? And all of these things need to be things that we do now and not tomorrow. And we should not allow this year to change into another year without dealing with these issues.
So Tom Quintito pointed out, you know, rightly, you both have run, right? You've needed voter turnout in elections. I want to play a little sound from Concord Town Clerk Carrie Mitary on the need for these reforms.
Vote by mail has been very popular in Concord. In fact, for the presidential election, over 70% of the voters had already cast their ballot before election day. And this is something that voters are expecting moving forward because it has been used for so many elections. I think they will be disappointed.
So last point on this, Tom Keene, I understand that there's extension of short-term measures. There are conversations about bigger, broader, long-term measures. Right now, my question to you is focused on the fact that there are a range of municipal elections coming up in January, February, March, where people were used to having options that now will not be there. Should we be worried about suppression of voter turnout in the very near term in these municipal elections?
And I think that's exactly what's going on. I mean, you've had municipal elections were held in a number of towns this month of December, and they all allowed early voting and mail-in voting. And then, boom, the clock strikes on January 1st, and suddenly very similar municipal elections are now back to you've got to actually show up in person unless you can really make some, you know, some excuse, which, as Tito points out, a lot of people just kind of lie their way through it. I think the impact is going to be that a whole bunch of people in these towns won't show up. And what's really interesting about that is that at the municipal level, your vote actually matters the most because the number of people who vote is so small that your vote is truly impactful. And those votes will be lost.
All right. Well, I do want to move on to another area of inaction. And I'm just going to say right now, our team has used every egg pun known to humanity this week. So I am fresh out of egg puns, but if you've got some, feel free to serve them up. I'm going to tell you straight. There was a 2016 ballot measure. It said more floor space for chickens. It passed easily, due to go into effect in January. We will not be able to sell eggs in Massachusetts that don't meet the requirements set in that bill. But since that bill, the industry has also said more space for chickens, but less floor space, more vertical space. And so unless we change the technicality of our law, like something like almost 90% of the eggs sold in the Commonwealth come from out of state may not be in compliance, we could face a serious shortage. 5 years in the making, Tito, why are we looking at no breakfast on January 2nd?
Tiziana, we have met in person, so you know this is a subject that is near and dear to my heart. But I think that we
I just love you, Tito.
I love you back. I think we absolutely need to have some flexibility here. And one of the other components that we are dealing with is the state of Massachusetts, where land is actually relatively expensive. And so I think the other component of, and this is interestingly a space that in the cannabis industry does play in terms of whether or not you can go vertical in terms of your growth. So I think there does need to be another dynamic here as to whether or not there is the opportunity to have a humane way of farming and raising eggs, but also deal with the very real reality that in the state of Massachusetts, land is the one thing that they're not generally making more of.
So, Tom, we had kind of this perfect moment covering this earlier this week when we spoke with John Pregantis, who's the owner of a business called Party Favors in Brookline. They do baking, they do party equipment or, you know, favors, as the name says, et cetera. He goes through hundreds of eggs every week, and we were talking to him about how this could affect him. Here he is.
I didn't realize it was happening in January. I probably actually voted for it in, you know, 2016. You know, I'm one of those people probably that voted for it and without realizing the impact it would do.
Sometimes these things sneak up on us, Tom, and it makes me wonder, what's the legislature's job in that case? I mean, obviously the people can hold their legislature accountable, but this is one of those cases where it sneaks up on us. But I mean, eggs can make up to 30% of a person's, you know, daily intake, depending. They're less expensive source of food than some others. This could really affect families on tight budgets significantly.
It really could. You know, I'm unpersuaded that this shortage is as much a crisis as it's cracked up to be, so to speak.
Pun number one.
And I do think the market will probably end up responding quickly, even if the legislature doesn't act. And quite frankly, if not, then we'll all be going to New Hampshire and picking up eggs as when we pick up our liquor. I mean, it's, you know, it is. I do suspect you'll start to see almost some illegal trade across borders. But I do think, first of all, I think the legislature eventually responds, but I also think that you will see markets respond more quickly than we may think. I'm more sanguine about it than most people.
Let's hear what Andrew thinks in West Roxbury. Andrew's calling. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Tito just stole my phone.
Oh, no, Andrew, sorry, you are cutting out. I think that you were hoping to get a pun and a point in. Sorry, we lost Andrew's line there, but I will say he told the producer before he came on that he was also saying, hey, worst comes to worst, you can go to New Hampshire. Andrew, Tom, on that one. But I do find myself thinking, how often are we saying that now? Okay, Massachusetts passes legislation, so now you'll just drive to New Hampshire to get it. Tito, that is not a sustainable long-term approach.
It's not sustainable. It means that we need to address the issues that we put forward. We need to be nimble in addressing them. Party Favors has made several of my birthday cakes. I do have to admit that. Also. And we also need to put in context that we are at a time of inflation that's over 6%. And so this is something that also is, again, on top of the issues that people are facing with the inflationary pressure. And for those who are on a budget and can't just do a couple of more hours, people who are on fixed incomes, this is something that could mean, in particular, this is kicking in January and February. This is a time when people are making decisions for food or heat. So we need to be really thoughtful and move quickly on this issue.
And hope
so
that Tom is right, too. There. Yeah, go, Tom.
Let me interrupt there, though. I mean, I think it's important to understand that when this legislation was first proposed, put before the voters, that the opponents made it very clear that no matter what, costs were going to rise for the eggs. And that's the case because they are insisting upon more humane conditions for the hens that are laying the eggs. Even if the legislature changes this to, say, be in accord with what other states do, you still will see eggs that are more expensive than they used to be. That was actually part and parcel of this legislation.
So I will be interested, if the legislature doesn't act, to revisit this at some point in January here on Radio Boston and see what's happening. Look at the prices, look at the supply, look at how it's impacting families. So we're going to put a bookmark there. Still with us, Tito Jackson and Tom Keene, both former Boston City Councilors, and you. And we're going to pivot for a few minutes now to a painful story, which continues to unfold in the community of Danvers. Do you have school-age kids? Are they talking about what has happened with the hockey teams, the wrestling teams, the incidences of racism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, hazing? Are you worried about similar incidents in your homeschool district? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Tito, Tom, I want to be clear. There is a lot to this story. We are not going to do all of it. I do want to remind our listeners, this started with outrage over attempts by the Danvers School Committee to keep private a set of homophobic violent and racist incidents by the Danvers High School hockey team, the 2019-2020 team. Later, anti-Semitic writings on bathroom stalls in at least one middle school. Then, the wrestling team suspended after a fight over racist remarks by a wrestler, which led to uncovering a disturbing Snapchat group. And then, a swastika, another anti-Semitic graffiti in the high school bathroom there, those last events just over the last week. I just want to say for today, I want to stay at the kind of the what the heck level, and I don't mean that glibly. I mean that pretty profoundly, Tito. What the heck?
Well, you know, shout out to my friends at ADL, Robert Treston, and his team who does this work on a day-to-day basis.
Anti-Defamation League, just to be clear.
Yeah, and one of the things that I learned from Robert is that you can't allow one of these things to go. And so what you see here is a culture of not having accountability and not addressing these issues. And in many of these towns, what you see is people wanting to protect the reputation of the town rather than addressing the real issues around racism, sexism, homophobia, oftentimes sexual assault, that are actually present. And so instead, it's this, this doesn't happen in our town. And the biggest failure that I see, and I realize that many of the young people have participated in this, and we do need to hold those individuals accountable, but the biggest failure is in adults. And is that adults have allowed this across the board from the top down in these situations, and as well as people in sports. And as a former athlete, I'm sure Tom was probably better than me, but as a former athlete, the leadership by coaches as well as athletic directors was so critical. And it's one of the things that held me accountable and made me the person that I am today. And so if that was not the case, and if we had the folks who didn't cultivate, in our case, it was young men who were playing football, into better young men than we would be, then you see what ends up happening. So it is critical that people stop putting their heads in the sand, hold themselves to account, and as Tom mentioned earlier, that elected officials at the local level have some of the most important roles to deal with these issues, and it, people need to take an opportunity to look at themselves in the mirror and address these issues.
So, Tom, I'm going to pick up on the culture thread that Tito just gave us, and in fact, we have some sound here from a member of the Anti-Defamation League of New England. This is Danica Manso-Brown, who's the director of education. We had her on back in November when we were first talking about the allegations against the Danvers 2019-2020 hockey team.
When there are culture problems that show up in schools, we're really just seeing symptoms of a much broader, larger social reality.
So then you've got the adults, and I want to break this out. You've got the adults who are in official positions of leadership, and then you've got family, parents, community. Let's start in the town hall. We'll go to the kitchen table in a second. What do you need to see from school committee members, from elected officials in the town right now?
So I think this is true of all towns, because one of the concerns is Danvers just an outlier, or did it just get caught? And my suspicion is that Danvers is not an outlier, but that rather this somehow they got caught in this, and that is also going on in towns across the Commonwealth. And so if you're sitting on a school board, what you really need to start doing is asking questions and really probing deeply in terms of all of the issues that Tito talked about. There are issues of sexual harassment, there are issues of racism, of anti-Semitism, and really starting to think about what's going on in the schools. Is this kind of behavior being addressed when it comes up? And I'd also say, echoing the ADL on this, this is actually an issue that probably starts with the parents, because the kids aren't born being anti-Semitic. The kids somehow learn this from an adult, and I would suspect that there is sometimes adults at the school who are aware of it or may even contribute to it. And there's, more importantly, the adults at home, their parents.
So I do want to pick up a caller on this. Lee's calling from Scituate. Go ahead, Lee.
Hello?
Yes, please go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, no, as to Danvers being an outlier, no, I find that really hard to believe. Just in Scituate alone, there have been instances, particularly of anti-Semitism. I know one parent who tried to contact the Anti-Defamation League, and they were told they could get them involved, but it might actually make things worse. And from their viewpoint, they thought they had a good relationship with the schools. The administration was made aware. There were coins being thrown at students, really ugly comments regarding Hitler and what should have happened to these students. And a guidance counselor had informed a parent that there was a basketball game a few years ago where even parents were throwing coins on the court when a team from Brookline had played.
Lee, I'm so sorry that that happened. Thank you for the call. You know, we don't have reporting on Lee's story in Scituate, but I will say when we covered this in November, we brought forth a number of stories that had been well covered in the press of parents, other family members engaging in, you know, racist behavior at various high school sporting events, et cetera. So we may not be able to confirm Lee's story firsthand, but certainly we've heard others. Tito, I want to leave room for you because I heard your reaction there.
Well, you know, you have as recent as last week, principals in Newton being attacked racially.
Newton North High School.
Newton North High School, and you know, so there. This is as Tom noted, something that is not necessarily a one-off. It's something that in this environment where you actually have folks who are more comfortable openly being racist and saying racist, sexist, homophobic, and anti-Semitic language, I think that is an issue. But I think we have to really dig in. We have to hold people accountable on each situation. We also have to begin to deal with these cultures that are there. And again, one team, oftentimes in high school, people play on multiple teams. So that this is not something that you know, it's out of the realm of possibility. And I also believe that it's, as Tom noted, people who are at the school committee level make a huge, huge difference. But I also don't want to negate young people's voices need to be listened to. That's another component, and you hear this across many of these stories, is that young people who have raised concerns multiple times have not been listened to. And that's a really critical component that these young people's voices should not be silenced and their issues should be elevated rather than dampened.
So, Tom Keene, I'm going to blow past the hubbubs and stay with this because this is an important subject. And before we are done with Week in Review, let me just come back to you one more time. In your mind, what is true north for a community in a moment like this?
True north would involve a community being willing to address these issues. And unlike what Lee says she observed in Scituate, not knocking down or shunning the people who raise concerns about racism, sexism, homophobia, and the like. And to really start to establish some norms of what is acceptable behavior, particularly within a high school, and one would hope within, once those kids graduate from that high school, maybe they become better adults than the people who taught them how to engage in such vile behavior.
All right. That is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor, writer for the Boston Globe, regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Tom, thanks for Week in Review today.
My pleasure.
And Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and now CEO of Verdant Medical. Always great to have you. Appreciate you today, too.
Happy holidays.
Thanks, you too.